All right, what section are we again? 42, Mary replies to Dylan. Right, 42, thanks. Ben has divided the class for group work, with four groups of four spread out about the room. Dylan, Mary, and Derek share the orange pleather couch underneath the corkboard. Jeff sits across from them in a pea-green, molded plastic chair borrowed from the Brady table. The study group sits in the corner as though conspiring, complete with their latest addition, Barry, an oily boy who's been known to mutter prime numbers under his breath. The classroom is silent. Everyone is reading to themselves, uncertain of how to start, and unwilling to be the first one the whole class hears talking. "Come on," Ben shouts. "I want to hear ideas, not silence. Some shouting, some slamming of fists on tables, some storming out of the room in indignation."
"What about fist fights?" Derek asks.
"Sure, just take it outside. If we get blood in the teacher's lounge, they won't let us use it anymore."
"Sweet. So let's get started."
Chatter starts up immediately among the groups.
"Okay," Mary says. "What did everybody get from the passage?"
"What's there to get?" Dylan says. "Labor makes everything valuable, and unused land is a waste. Look, right here. Land left wholly to nature, da-da-da-da-da-da, is called, as indeed it is, a waste. Same stuff as before."
"Yeah," Mary replies, "that's true. But this time he mentions government."
"Yeah, I guess. But how does government make labor less valuable, or unused land less wasteful?"
"Did you do all the reading?" Mary asks.
"Yeah, of course I did."
And he had, too. Sure, he had been a little distracted by his plans for the seawall, but he had caught the gist of everything pretty well. And like Jeff said, Ben will go through it all anyway, so why kill himself translating?
"Well, I don't know," Mary says. "What do you guys think?"
"Don't ask me," Derek says. "I never understand Locke until Ben translates for us. Half of what's said is just him repeating what he just said."
"Yeah."
"Jeff?" Mary asks.
"I don't care," Jeff says.
Mary rolls her eyes.
"Hey, have you guys seen the new Shakira video?" Derek asks, leaning forward in his seat.
"Oh, God, yes," Jeff says.
Mary scoffs.
"I think so," says Dylan.
"If you think so, you haven't seen the video," Derek says.
"I don't know. I just don't think she's that hot."
"Are you kidding me?" Derek says.
"Yeah, Dylan. I mean, I turn the sound off, but I sure as hell don't change the channel."
"That is disgusting," Mary says.
Jeff looks at her and shrugs.
"I lost interest in her after that video where she's covered in oil."
I can't believe what I'm hearing," Derek says, staring off, eyes wide like he's been struck blind.
"Yeah, man, just stop talking. You don't know what you're talking about."
"Since when is motor oil sexy? It looks like someone drove her off into a ditch. And the dancing thing, it was sexy at first, sure, but..."
"How we doing on section 42? Ben asks, coming alongside the couch to tamp Dylan on the shoulder. Today it's a white linen blazer with gray linen slacks and a gray and white plaid shirt.
We're getting there, thanks," Mary replies.
"Good. We're going to start up again in a couple minutes, so finish up."
"Okay."
Dylan starts again when Ben's a safe distance away.
"Look, she dances like she has jumper cables attached to her breasts. That's all I'm saying."
Jeff's eyes widen.
"You mean like with the clamps attached to..."
"Oh my God, we so need to move on right now. Section 42, does anyone else have anything to say?"
"No, nope, no."
"So what are we going to say when we're asked what this section is about?"
"Like I said before, same thing as every time."
"Fine," Mary says. "We'll see what Dr. Ben has to say."
"Sounds good to me," Dylan says.
He slouches a little in the couch and looks over to Jeff.
He looks lighter to Dylan in some way. and not in a skin tone sort of way, because that'd be near impossible. It doesn't take long to hit him.
Where's all your, you know, jewelry?
Jeff stripped down to 2 small earrings in each ear, and that's it. No studs, no spikes, no leather.
I just didn't feel like wearing them. What's the matter?
Nothing. Just can't remember the last time I saw you without them.
Get fucked. All right, time's up. Move your seats so everybody can see everybody. Okay? So, let's talk about these sections. First up, section 42. What you got for us?
The group looks back and forth at each other to see who's willing to cave and speak for the group. Dylan is quick to take up the responsibility.
Well, basically, we decided it's just like the other sections, really. Labor makes things valuable and unused land is a waste.
Ben presses a finger to his lips in thought.
Okay. Anything else?
Well, we did notice he mentions government, Mary adds.
All right, interesting. In what context?
That is the quote.
Oh, Mary says. That the increase of lands and the right of employing them is the great art of government.
Good, good.
I think there's a little more before that. Could you read it for us?
This shows how?
Yeah, that's it. Shows is fine.
Mary carefully traces the line with her finger.
This shows how much numbers of men are to be preferred to largeness of dominions.
Okay, great. So what does this sentence say about labor value and unused land?
Some hands go up in the study group.
We're not opening it up to the class just yet. I want this group to answer.
Yes, Dylan.
Well, numbers of men are preferred to largeness of dominion probably means labor is more valuable than land.
Very good. Continue.
But I don't see how government changes anything. It doesn't make unused land suddenly useful or something.
Dylan throws his arm over the couch's back, pleased with his off-the-cuff response.
Ben seems less convinced.
Interesting. Mary, Jeff, Derek, thoughts?
Well, Mary says, I think he's saying that government is designed to claim land and make it useful, and that's all we've been talking about so far. But this time it's more than just one person.
Excellent, Mary. So we're starting to hit complexities now, moving beyond the individual level. Do you agree with Mary, Derek?
Yes.
Well, after I hyped it up, you probably couldn't disagree, could you?
No.
All right. How about you, Jeff? Contributions?
No.
Okay, then, let's move on to... Wait, Dylan says, raising a hand.
Oh. Yes, Dylan?
But why would he talk about government as a tool for claiming and using land if all you need is your own labor to claim something? Isn't that redundant?
Excellent question, Dylan. I think this next section is going to clear that up for you.
Jennifer, you've been chomping at the bit the entire time. Are you ready to talk about section 45?
Yes, Dr. Ben.
Go right ahead.
Locke starts by saying labor alone was originally the only requirement for claiming land, as there was so much common land to begin with. People were content with this until populations grew and land became scarcer. At that point, communities got together and settled territory boundaries, or, as Locke says, settled the property which labor and industry began. By doing so, they have, quote, by common consent, given up their pretenses to their natural common right. Locke concludes the passage by saying that there's still, quote, great tracts of ground to be found among the less civilized people in the world. The group agreed it was a fairly appalling rationale for European colonialism.
Wow, Ben says, starting a small clap as he talks. Fantastic job, you guys. And the part with the colonialism? Really going above and beyond there. I guess you're catching on to Locke's language, huh?
Barry's been a big asset to our group, Jennifer says, smiling. Barry shakes his head while muttering something indecipherable.
Well, okay, great. Does that answer your question, Dylan?
No.
Really? What don't you understand, then?
I understand, I just don't agree.
Okay, well, what do you disagree with, then? Why should common right go away just because some kings agreed to get rid of it? That doesn't sound common to me.
Let's keep going and see if your question isn't answered, okay?
You guys just great on 45. Let's hear about section 50.
Okay, Regina.
So, this passage talks a lot about money and how, like, well, the words that jumped out at us were disproportionate and unequal possession of the earth. So by, like, agreeing to the idea of money, Locke says the world agrees to inequality.
Good, we're halfway there.
Now he talks about decay in this section. Remember, we talked about that the other day, too.
Oh, yeah.
Well, like, we thought the decay part meant that, like, well, decay comes from hoarding stuff that can decay. But gold doesn't decay. So if you say a gold coin equals a loaf of bread, then it's like hoarding a loaf of bread without wasting it?
Yes. Perfect analogy, Regina.
And that's crucial. Once value is assigned to non-perishable items, labor and effort aren't just about self-preservation anymore. They can be stockpiled in the form of money and exchanged for goods and services that go beyond simple survival. But by agreeing to this system of creature comforts, people agree to inequality. Your successful potato farmer sells off his surplus for gold. He gets more land because he can expand without being wasteful, and uses that land to make more sellable surplus. Eventually, so many people are dependent on his potatoes and the gold he offers to harvest those potatoes that he becomes a king by default. Government is formed. It takes money to justify surplus. Money makes kings, kings mean government, and government makes laws, defining property and eliminating common right. Make sense?
Yes, Dylan.
How is it fair that someone can be disadvantaged from birth by a system they didn't even agree to?
Well, why should people be allowed to take up acres of land if they're not going to use it in any positive way?
Dylan, why should people have more power in our society just because they have a big lawn they don't even cut themselves?
Dylan! Enough!
The forefathers didn't idolize Locke because he made a strong case for common right. They liked him because he built a logical argument in favor of money and the state. I'll agree it's far from a perfect system, but you have to recognize it's the system that allows us to be here at all, and not back at home tilling the fields.
Now, I appreciate your enthusiasm for the topic, but we need to move on.
Let's hear about section 46.
Dylan clenches his spiral notebook in his left hand, cover folded over. The book is warped with tension. He stares down at the words, pretending to read as the class carries on discussion. The script on the page decontextualizes to a string of points and loops, and he takes the book with both hands when it starts to tremor.
Ben was wrong. Dylan knows it. The law is wrong. Any system that allows such wanton wastefulness while ensuring permanent disadvantage is no system to live under.
Dylan looks up from the book when Ben starts writing on the board. Jeff must have been watching him the whole time, because he catches Dylan's eye as soon as he looks up. It's a look of apology and sympathy, and Dylan ignores it. Jeff is wrong, too. Jeff's wrong, and Ben's wrong, and John's wrong, and Locke's wrong, and it's all wrong, and no one's going to show him different. If the system is fucked, then fuck the system.
Dylan trots down the basement stairs and turns on the computer. He stands over the keyboard impatiently, backpack slung over one shoulder, moving the mouse back and forth with his left hand as though shaking a Polaroid. His right hand holds 3 packets of geranium seeds, acquired from Jeff yesterday on the ride to school.
A flourish of keystrokes and Dylan has the information he wanted. Mostly cloudy, 50% chance of rain. He decides to check his email on a whim, even though all he ever gets is spam and forwarded messages of patriotism from his uncle. His pulse skips a note as he catches sight of the last email. Dear users, after spending nearly 2 weeks working round the clock to preserve the over 12 million characters stored in our databases, we are ready to proclaim World of Demons once again is ready for warfare. Please understand that with rollbacks, a small amount of character data is lost. Any items or experience accrued within 6 hours of the server attacks have been lost permanently. We deeply regret the inconvenience. If your character has experienced any instance of anomalous data wipe, excessive decrease in level, disappearance of long-possessed items, etc., contact technical support at technicalsupport@tsunami.com. Let loose the hounds of war. Tsunami Studios. 6 hours. The night before rollback, he had raided the Crypts of Sargon with his guild and had finally gotten the Staff of the Golden Phoenix. The Staff of the Golden Phoenix, after 6 months of waiting. Whatever, I've got seeds to plant, he mumbles, turning off the monitor. It's humid as anything outside. The sky is the color of a Q-tip run the length of a dirty car. Gray and white and somehow satisfying. It's only a matter of time until the rain comes, but Dylan's confident he can get everything planted in time. As he passes the houses en route to the wall, he thinks about yesterday's anger. There had been time for reflection later that day, while tilling the soil for today's planting, and with that reflection came clarity. He realized he isn't mad at people, or at least these people, his neighbors. They're good people, by and large. They're just well-trained players in a game so ingrained and seemingly natural, you'd swear money really did grow on trees. And he isn't mad at the system either, though he believes this is where the anger should lie. Being angry at the system, he realized, is about as useful as being angry at a mountain. Far better to exploit the cracks and crevices than to bemoan a monolith. A monolith indeed, Dylan thinks to himself as the first of the massive smokestacks appears on a distant peninsula. Somewhere along the way, inequality had gone from a byproduct of the monetary system to the purpose of the monetary system. Somewhere along the way, property went from a way to accumulate wealth to a way to display wealth. These houses, these pillars of wealth, are little more than precursors to graveyard obelisks. Both pervert their natural tasks by aggrandizing far beyond necessity. But cracks present themselves in places like the seawall, which Dylan now approaches. The wet towel humidity and dense greenery of the Crescent Cove, made greener still by the muted skylight, gives the Long Island oasis a Costa Rican feel. The waves swell a little higher in anticipation of the storm. He touches the signet of cinnamon gum before scaling the wall, the mark all plasticky and formed to his thumb. Dylan takes off his backpack and sits overlooking the bay. The reeds are conspicuously quiet, the animals sensing the weather. He takes out his notebook and works some on his new drawing project, a pastel depiction of the looming smokestacks. He likes rubbing the colors together and the slick satisfaction under his fingers. Why he had never thought to use Aunt Grace's Christmas present before is beyond him. Clouds from the west slide home like bank security steel, catching Dylan off guard. A bit anxiously now, he gets to his task, taking out a trowel and surgical gloves and scanning the seed instructions. His actions go on autopilot as he indulges his new favorite pastime. Thinking. Beachfront property. His own little crack in the system. In a culture where status symbols are accumulated joylessly, for the sake of accumulation, little parcels of land like this must exist all around the world. Neglected back pastures and saggy boathouses,
disinherited mountain trails, and long-forgotten weeping willows. These things will never be seen by dinner guests or important clients. Maintenance is pointless. That's where Dylan comes in. He doesn't want the rights to the property or any form of compensation. He just wants a spot that's his. Not because a piece of paper says so, but because common sense says so. A place to work, to take pride in, to see potential in. A spot that's his in all the ways that matter. He's through with all the holes fairly quickly. 2 rows of 30, 3 inches deep and 3 inches apart. As he plants the seeds and slides back the earth, his thoughts take him to World of Demons. He sees more clearly now why it's such an addictive game. Escapism and accumulation come together in unprecedented ways, with each gold piece, experience point, and magic item increasing your in-game status just a little more. And while it's the exotic fantasy world that starts you playing, it's the status symbols that keep you playing, long after you've accomplished all the game has to offer. You sit around the capital city in your badass suit of armor, so newbies will message you to tell you how cool you look. You compete in player versus player warfare 5 hours a night, even though you don't want to play all that much, just to sustain your in-game title of High Warlord. You go to the forums to openly mock the noobs and dazzle others with your knowledge of the game. And all this energy devoted to a game, an accumulation of status symbols that mean even less than their real-life counterparts. What could be accomplished if even a quarter of the time devoted to World of Demons was instead devoted to a good cause? 40 hours a week, if averaged out...
Hey! Who the hell are you? What are you doing on my property?
Dylan lurches backwards and loses his balance, nearly tripping over the wall and into the water. He catches himself on the wall's ledge and the trowel escapes his hand, skipping down the concrete ramp and into the rising waters. He looks to the stairs, the old, disrepaired stairs leading up to somewhere unknown. There stand his accusers. One is Zack, one hand on a rickety banister and one pointing at Dylan, the smug satisfaction of a snitch on his face. The other is a few steps behind, dressed in a look of wide-eyed fury and a golf shirt that once reminded Dylan of Byzantine art. It starts to rain.
Well, what are you still here for? This isn't your property. Get off.
Dylan doesn't know what to do. Everything that makes him who he is telling him to obey. To obey an adult. To obey the law. To obey the shrill pounding in his chest. But Dylan doesn't move. Vince's breath becomes audible from 20 feet away. He lumbers past his son and makes for Dylan like a manager charging the home plate umpire. He crouches down to get in Dylan's face.
I'm going to say this one more time. Get off my property now!
Dylan turns his head from Vince and looks down at the water. This isn't your property. Vince leans forward over the wall to look at Dylan's face.
What?
Dylan takes a shuddering breath. He turns to look Vince in the eye. A shuddering breath. Without moving his eyes, he puts one foot on top of the wall, then the other, and stands up to full height. On the wall, he's taller. All the beach, up to the tide lines, is public property. That includes the seawalls. I am on public property. The rain starts to pick up, matching the pace of a light jog. Vince scratches the back of his head in a short burst. Against his short, shorn scalp, it sounds like a doctor signing off on a release form.
You're really asking for it, kid.
Vince's stature is too imposing for Dylan to stand toe-to-toe against. He turns his back to him and walks the top of the wall down to his backpack.
Crouching down, he fiddles with the pockets as though looking for something.
Sounds like you don't know your own property lines.
Okay, smart guy, fine. Vince takes out his cell phone. Hello? Is this the police?
Yes. I need an officer to come to my house. There's someone trespassing on my property that refuses to leave.
Vince manages to turn even the street address into a threat with his tone. Zach comes up alongside his father, the same self-satisfied look on his face.
Dylan's clothing is starting to soak.
Yes, and have him come through the house to the back. There's a set of stairs that lead to the water.
Thank you.
Vince flips his phone closed.
Well, you're in for it now.
We could have done this the easy way. Now you're looking at trespassing, destruction of property, harassment. You could be going to court.
You're going to look real stupid when you're wrong.
What was he even saying anymore? Dylan knows he's lying. He had heard something once about tidelines being public domain, but who knows if that was true, and why would it possibly apply to seawalls?
He's past the point of control now, in too deep to do anything but claw and scratch. His innocence pairs with his imagination to create impossible, half-formed scenarios of punishment, embarrassment, and shame, each one concluding with a heartbreaking look of disappointment from his mother. He's never been more afraid in his life, but he refuses to back down.
The rain steps up to a run, dispelling the remaining humidity and turning the bay air chilly. Zach and his father cover themselves under the canopy of the hill a few feet to Dylan's left. Dylan remains exposed on the wall, trying not to look cold. Father and son look most alike when they're smiling.
So, Vince says, did you really think you could push someone around smaller than you and get away with it?
Dylan wouldn't have thought comedy was possible in a situation like this, but there it was.
Man, he really has you and your wife played, doesn't he?
Your son charged me. I was defending myself.
Vince looks at Zach.
I charged him because he was making fun of me, he pouts.
Your son introduced himself by throwing a football at my head.
You just missed catching it.
That's not even a good lie. You really are retarded.
Hey, Vince shouts, getting back in Dylan's face. Don't you dare call my son names, ever. Especially not on my property. I believe 10 of his lies before I believe one of your truths.
Vince is a foot away from Dylan, pointing up at him with his index finger in a furious pose. There are so many things Dylan is terrified of right now. But suddenly Vince isn't one of them.
10 lies before one truth? That doesn't even make sense.
And all this barking, barking. All he's good at is yelling loud. Not even yelling things that make sense.
It's unnerving, but it doesn't lead to anything but more yelling.
He's just a big, loud idiot.
It had taken him over 2.5 years, but Dylan is finally a teenager.
Yeah, his mom believes his lies too. That's the problem.
Don't you dare bring my wife into this, you little brat!
Hey, Dad, look, Zach says, holding up the discarded seed packet.
He was planting flowers. What a fag.
What?
Vince walks over to his son and examines the packet.
Geraniums, huh? What, were they out of pansies?
Dylan says nothing as the two laugh at his expense. Vince squints at Dylan.
And are you wearing surgical gloves to plant flowers?
Seriously, do you have a mental disorder?
It seems like you're the retarded one, kid, not Zach.
Planting flowers on someone else's property without them knowing? You realize that's crazy, right?
Dylan unzips his bag and throws the dirty gloves inside. His hair is sopping wet.
You have all this beautiful property, and you don't give a shit about it. You just let it go to crap because all you care about is impressing people with your view over expensive dinners.
If you can't impress someone, it's not worth it, right? You don't want friends. You want jealous worshippers.
Dylan readies himself for the barking. What comes instead is a smile.
Let me tell you something, kid. A little free advice before the cops come. Money is everything. It is the only thing. You think it's all about impressing people? I don't give a fuck if they're impressed or not, so long as they know I'm better than they are. It's about power. You think you're unique? You think you understand the truth? I don't give a fuck what you think the truth is. People like me make the truth. People like me own people like you. And one day, when you grow up, people like Zach will own people like you. That's the truth. Deal with it.
The wind is whipping now. No one is safe from the rain.
You're wrong.
Vince laughs.
About what?
You're just a shallow, hollow person.
Oh, here it is, yeah.
You see, Zach, poor people like to tell themselves that rich people are really unhappy. It makes them feel better about being poor. I know you live around here somewhere, so you can't even be that poor. You're just a loser.
Trust me, I'm happier than you'll ever be. I've done more things than you'll ever do. I've seen more than you'll ever see. I've got more friends than you'll ever have. And fucking surprise, I have friends. I have more money than you'll ever have. I've slept with more women than you'll ever sleep with. Dad, he's never even kissed a girl.
Oh, I know. He's a loser, son. If we're not unhappy or stupid or friendless, he has nothing to live for. Dylan looks out over the water. He's been looking out over the water for some time now. A shuddering breath. I'm not leaving the wall.
Ha! Oh yeah? That's it?
Fine, what do I care? Get more wet.
Cops will be here soon.
Dylan doesn't reply. The gusts off the water are starting to taper. Dylan's waterlogged t-shirt is suctioned to the pudge of his belly. Vince surveys the land behind the wall, Zach trailing behind.
You know, I don't think the realtor brought me down here when I bought the plot.
You're right, kid. This is a beautiful spot, even in the rain. All wild and natural.
You know what?
Maybe we'll fix this place up. Fix the steps, cut down the trees, knock this wall down,
put up a deck.
It'd be a nice place to eat dinner in the summers.
Yeah, I like it.
I like it too, Dad.
Good.
Dylan grits his teeth. Fear is a distant emotion now, far eclipsed by a shivering rage of his own. Something is different from all the other times. He wants to hurt Vince. Badly. He wants to kill him. To smash his skull against a jutting piece of wall and see his brain spill out like runny eggs. He wants it badly. He counts the rings on the smokestacks, 12 of them, over and over again, over and over again. The sound of footsteps brings all the fear right back. The officer wears a police-issue rain shell with the crest on the right breast. It's tucked into his pants to allow easy access to his belt. A government-issued pistol is holstered at his side.
Okay, what's the problem here?
Thank you for coming, officer. This boy here won't get off my property. I need you to escort him off.
Officer, isn't all the beach up to the tide lines public property?
Yes, that's right, he says, hands on hips.
So shouldn't the seawall be public property too?
They are public property.
Really? What?
The officer holds up his hands. Wait, hold on. The way it works is the walls are public property, but it's trespassing to be on them.
What?
Okay. Thank you, officer.
But how can it be public property if the public can't use it?
Son, I don't know the particulars. I just know the law.
But that's garbage! It doesn't make any sense!
Son, you're gonna have to leave now, the cop says firmly, somehow gently. Dylan looks back over the water again. It's hard to see anything through fog and welled tears. The rain is dying down. He slides on his backpack and slowly walks the wall's top, always looking straight ahead. Zach and Vince are in his periphery, arms folded, silent. As he passes by, he can feel their superiority radiating off them. The storm-swelled waters claim all the beachfront for themselves, right up to the reeds. He steps off the wall a few feet from where the waves break, the sand malleable like putty. A wave comes by to submerge his shoes.
How about I give you a ride home, son?
Dylan turns to look at the officer. His gold-rimmed glasses are speckled with water droplets. His face lacks any definition, the relevant contours all stored away in baby fat. The part of his black hair has been washed away, leaving pointed tufts splayed left and right. His smooth lips, pale from the cold, conceal naturally perfect teeth. His eyes are the eerie blue of Argentine glaciers, whites charged red with emotion. His eyebrows thin to a clean point. His nose is straight and runny. There's a freckle on his right ear people often mistake for an earring. No, thank you. The officer calls after him, but Dylan keeps going, walking a strip of half-dry sand, edging the reeds. He hears Vince shouting as though it were still pouring.
Thanks for coming out, officer. Can I offer you a drink?
The officer's reply is too soft to hear.
Oh, no, I insist. Come on, let me show you my rec room.
Dylan walks with his head down, arms folded. Each breath convulses with suppressed emotion. For some reason, through the rage and tears, he thinks of his father, about something he said, or rather did, a long time ago. It happened at the Howard Johnsons, where he and his father used to stay on weekends. Dylan had stubbed his toe in the bathroom and was hopping around the room, crying. Soon the pain subsided, and all that was left was an angry child. Dylan's father took Dylan into the bathroom.
Bad bathtub, he said, slapping the tub on its ledge. Bad, bad bathtub.
Dylan joined in, yelling, bad bathtub, and slapping the tub until his tiny hands were pink. When he was through, Dylan's father gave him a hug. You let Dad know if the bathtub hurts you again, okay? But this isn't a bathtub, and he isn't three. And fathers don't save the day, and truth doesn't mean anything. Bad people win, good people lose, and everyone else tries not to notice. So lies the shade of his day. But this is life, and that burning throat is high-octane vitriol. This is real, and that stooped posture is fate's buoy tug. This is Dylan, patron saint of sagging walls. His road to salvation sinks softly.